Okay, by way of kind of recap, you're going to sit for a second. Okay, that's fine. It's great to be here, and we kind of come here on a twofold mission. One is to say thank you, and we genuinely mean that, and you'll hear me say that a few times, and you'll hear Diana say that a few times. And we say thank you because these stories aren't our stories. I think at some point you kind of realize that God is doing something way bigger than what he was doing with us as a family. And genuinely, these stories are your stories as well as they're our stories. Because as a church, you've invested into us and you've invested into the foundation. And that we would love you to feel that these stories are your stories. And that's why we come to share them with you. And so we'd love to say thank you. Thank you for partnering with us. Thank you for partnering with the foundation. Thank you for being interested. And we genuinely couldn't do it. We can't be where we are without churches that partner with us and without individuals that pray for us and partner with us. So please hear a massive thank you from us. And the second reason that we come is hopefully to inspire you with the stories that of what God is doing where we are in the world and where we're located. I often speak for too long and too much. So one way of stopping someone who speaks for too long, and I frequently get told this, is just to show a video to recap certain important things, because they can edit me when I'm on a video. Some of you may not know the kind of backdrop of why we're here or what we've been doing, and for many of you this is a familiar story, but a couple of years ago we were hijacked by God. That's how we kind of describe it. Our plans were just to kind of quietly go about doing something with some friends on a township called Vreugde in Cape Town, which nobody's ever heard of. And we were at a New Wine conference that summer, and really the kind of the way God provided for that project was way over and above what we could imagine. And when I came to speak here last, we had a half-built center, I think. We probably had the foundations laid, and we were on the verge of going out to live in Cape Town as a family. This video captures, we set up a video camera in the room of the education center, one of our teaching rooms, and captured the young people coming in for the first time. That they came into the center. They'd never seen the inside of the center before. It will show you the outside of the center. It will show you what's been built, and it will save us having to recap that kind of journey in 3 minutes, and then we'll share with you the stories of the last year. So if you could show the video just to recap why we're here and what we're doing, this will do some of that for you.
I believe with my whole heart that this morning, this day, this moment, this time is your God-appointed time. God moved and miraculously poured out provision for this project. Our heart has always been to create a space where young people can come and it's a safe environment, where they can feel loved, where they can feel accepted, and where they can actually sit down and do some homework, where they have tutors that support them, that encourage them, that are role models.
To everybody at New Wine for all that you gave to see local churches really changing nations.
Just glad to be able to report back and faithfully show you what's been built. So thank you for partnering with us. Just continue to join us on the story as it unfolds. So we've done what we said we were going to do, which is a nice feeling to come back and say that we have a building. We've avoided major disasters of major overruns or completely running out of money. We've nearly run out of money a few times, I have to tell you, but each time God has come through for us and provided for us, and it fills us with hope. When we watch that video again, we're reminded of the hope of the gospel and the hope that we had on the first time we stood on that plot of sand and were filled with faith that God could do it. The hope we saw in the learners' faces as they came into the center for the first time and they looked around at their new classroom environment and the hope that we still have for that area and that community that we work in. And it's great to come in like in Holy Week and around Easter and unashamedly preach the gospel. And it's a great week to do that. And 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 3 says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and into inheritance that can never perish, spoil or fade, kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in this last time." And I love the phrase that we're given there, that the gospel is living hope. So the fact Jesus raised from the dead, the fact that he didn't remain in the tomb, that the fact that he didn't remain on the cross and that was the end of the story, gives us living hope. It gives us a gospel truth that is alive, something that moves, something that gives breath and life into the communities where it is preached, where it takes root, something that gives life into individuals who receive that gospel truth. And we're going to share some stories, a hope of hope, with you tonight, where we've seen the gospel transform and impact individuals' lives, where we've seen it impact community that we work in, and where we've even seen it impact the government which rules over us. And there's something of this sense of anticipation of us, of what God may do even going forward, where we would dare to hope and where we would dare to believe that this gospel will still continue to see life, will still continue to see fruit. Diana's going to come and share with us now just the impact on some of the girls that she's been working with and what she's been doing to bring about hope in the community.
Hi everyone. So where my bit comes in is that I had a real passion to kind of work with young women in the community, but we wanted to make sure that kind of the work was relevant, that it was really key to where they were at in the community, in the society. And we partnered by some, like, amazing connection that God made. I had this, like, on my heart that we were going to do, like, this discipleship program or something, but I wasn't sure, like, how it was going to come together. And we went to a conference in Durban, and I met this lady, this incredible lady that, like, set up this initiative called the Dignity Campaign. And it so happened that she, like, lived in Cape Town, 5 minutes from where you were. And, yeah, amazing, like, how God put us together. So the Dignity Campaign is, it's, like, an opportunity to impact girls by giving them free, like, reusable pads and a menstrual cup. Because what happens is girls in South Africa, like 2.1 million girls, live below the poverty line. So that means they can't afford sanitary products. And that is, like, for us women here in the UK, like, we totally take it for granted that we could just pop down to Tesco's in time of the month. And it doesn't have to interrupt the rest of our lives. But for these girls, there literally is either a pack of pads or food at home. So what happens is that they miss school altogether, and that will amount to more than like 60 days, I'll say like a lot more than that, but a year that they miss from their education, and that impacts, it's, I mean, it's terrible that they don't have supportive environments, like at home, they don't have the family structure to carry on their education. The system means that if they fail the year, they fail the subjects, they have to retake, then that means more money that parents have to give towards schooling, so the easy thing is just drop out. So that was one of the, like, the aims of the Dignity Campaign. And then the discipleship part of it is saying, like, let's have a holistic approach to the girls' development, and let's address issues like, yes, relationships and HIV and AIDS awareness. There's trafficking, that's a big thing in South Africa. The just abuse that happens in the home. We talk about identity, belonging, purpose, and really just getting to the heart of, like, where are the, like, negative cycles that these girls have experienced throughout their lives, that they have parents that, yeah, that have had no really good kind of grounding of what family structure should look like, what healthy lifestyle is, or and spiritually it, where we're at, like, the there's a lot of I think the kind of, I would say, like, African traditional kind of religion, where it's very superstitious, and the girls and boys are put through different rituals and things that actually spiritually have a lot of oppression, and there's a lot of demonic kind of activity there, and so they're caught between this world that is really it's just hopeless, exactly. And so we wanted to really address, like, that, like, so it's the practical stuff of saying we want to support you through your education, we want to make your life, restore dignity, because, like, come on, the enemy comes to steal, kill, destroy, and in any way, if we could just take the hope away from these young women, then right, we're going to try to work on, like, a practical basis. But then on the other side, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, how can we help these girls? So yeah, this is the Cherish Dignity program, and it's a 12-week program that we run with them, and we did it in from August to December, and it was amazing, like, the response we got from these girls. They're just so ready to receive and to have someone just talk about these issues with them, because they don't have family, like, really to talk to about things like, yeah, simple things like their periods, or let alone, yeah, relationships and careers and what do I do with my life. And so yeah, it was a really, really amazing experience. And this year we're going to be running two more groups, and so we're going to and I had this, like, prayer. I was like, God, right, how are we going to make this happen for the mums? Because what I'm passionate about is, like, breaking those negative cycles and creating a good, like, structure for parents to, like, communicate with their young, like, daughters. But we hope to do it with the boys too one day. Do something very similar. We create, yeah, good communication between them. And we managed to get some funding. And now I'm going to be running, like, a Mums and Daughters Day. And we're going to give the mums also a menstrual cup or the pad, and just have a fun day where we're going to have, like, activities and discussions, and yeah, just really, it's something that they've never ever done before. And I'm sure, like, even for their own, in their own, like, teenage years, that wasn't the case. So yeah, just creating some new, like, yeah, structures of, like, positive, healthy living, and yeah, and breaking, yeah, those negative cycles. So that's what I'm really working on at the moment.
It's often when we think about this, and in fact, Diana actually has the pads here, by the way, which, yeah, I'm so meant to say. She says I often get embarrassed to say that, but she has the pads here. If you'd like to see them, you're very excited to tell them, but if you would like to see them, you can see them afterwards.
I know, it's like a little cringe-worthy moment.
I know. I often try to avoid this moment in the middle of the talk, which is about to happen when you get
there. But if you want to speak to me afterwards, I can show you, like, and
they are there.
Hairwax and everything, and just.
And as you can see, somebody passionate about girls and passionate about the restoration of somebody's dignity and passionate about a gospel-driven approach to mentoring young women in a community like we work in, where 50% of students don't finish high school, where of the 50% that stay in school, only 60% will go up to A-level. It has a huge impact when we remember that often the gospel still at its heart is about one person sitting in front of another person and saying, do you know what, I've found an immense hope. and it's a living hope, and it was found in Jesus. And yes, I want to meet your needs, and yes, I want to share with you, but also I want to help you spiritually. I want to speak to you about faith. I want to speak to you about hope. I want to speak to you and be able to connect with you and lead you into a new place of freedom and into a new space of freedom. Frekhund is incredibly overcrowded. It was a township that was created for effectively 1,600 homes for 8,000 people. Even that was based on overcrowded one-bedroom homes where you may have a family of five living with one room, one living room, one kitchen. We've now got 43,000 people estimated living in the community. That was already overcrowded with the facilities for 8,000. You can imagine being a teenage girl growing up where there is complete overcrowding, where there is no clinic, where there is no secondary school, where there are gangs that frequently believe and in many aspects do rule the streets, where the police are scared to come in maybe on accounts, and where often the police are subject to corruption when they do come in. That kind of environment for all the young people we work with, but especially for women and the young girls, is incredibly, incredibly vulnerable, hard, scary. And the impact of a program like this for the one, two, for the 12, for the multiple girls that will come next year, it's something of the gospel that comes to life in those kind of environments, that comes to life when we work with and when Diana works with the young women that we work with. We now run 80 students in the centre. We've got 80 students coming four nights a week and once on the weekend. Of our 80 students, we've got 100% stay in school. Of our 12 matriculants, which is A-level, 12 that have reached it up to A-level, we had 100% of them go on to either further education, uni, or go into jobs. We've actually employed two of them ourselves to work for the foundation. The foundation's grown from 8 people working for it to now 33 of us working together, running across 5 projects. But at its heart, it's still about giving hope to the one, actually. We hope. It's still about meeting the one and encouraging them on and sharing faith with them and meeting their practical needs and sharing the love of God with them and holding this true, that when we believe that Jesus raised from the dead, it brought us into a living hope. And we long to bring others into that living hope. I want to tell you about a young man we work with called Neville. I like Neville because he's got a gold tooth and a great smile. And I'm from East London, and if you've got a gold tooth, you've made it, okay? So we love Neville, and there was something about meeting Neville. From the moment I met him, I knew I had a heart to work with this guy and to move forward with him. And he shared some of his story with me. We've gone on to employ Neville. But as he started to share his story with me, we hadn't employed him at that stage. And he told me that he'd first gone to prison when he was 15 years old. And at the age of 15, he couldn't read or write. He dropped out of school because the gangs would often have crossfire going in near the school, and it would sometimes come into the school playground. It would sometimes overspill into the learning environment. In a school which was already overcrowded, potentially 50, 60 students for one teacher, and drastically under-resourced. And it wasn't a world I could understand. It wasn't a world that, it was a long, far cry from my own experience growing up. But as I heard him speak, the all too familiar pattern of falling into a gang and aspiring to be a gangster, when your family structure falls apart, when you're effectively bringing yourself up and living on the streets in a township, it unfortunately is an all too familiar story. And Neville spoke to me about when he came out of prison and when he connected with some people at the local library, and when these people at the local library introduced him to volunteering, taught him to read and write, when they spoke of Christ, when they spoke of the love of God, when he connected with the local church. These weren't our project. This wasn't our project. It was another project. But the heart of what he was explaining to me filled me with hope. It filled me with hope that the gospel still impacts the one and still changes the lives of individuals that we connect with and that we meet with. Neville went on to ask me to pray for him to be healed of a bad back. We prayed for him. His back was healed and he went back to work. I'm one of these people who never wants to pray for people for healing. I've just got to tell you that. I'm one of these people that's very scared that it won't work and ends up hoping that the extra special holy person in the group will step forward at that time and take responsibility for this moment. But in this case, it was the one in 1,000 that you hope for when they're actually healed and they can go back to work. He lost his job, so I thought, where are we going with this. We prayed for him to go back to work, and he's lost his job. And he came to us for work. So we offered him a job, and we took him on, and we took him working with us. We had an opportunity for him to be our handyman, which he took on. And he'd been working, and he'd been engaging really, really well with what we were doing. And then chaos broke out in the township where we were working. We were on riots. We were on lockdown, and I'll talk about a little bit about that later. And he'd worked a load of extra hours. And he'd overdone his hours, and he'd really put in a load of effort at a stressful time. So we thought, you know, the right thing to do when someone works overtime is to try and reward them. So we thought we'd give him a small bonus, and financially we'll try and help him out. It wasn't anything special. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary. It was nothing the other staff would have particularly taken note of. It was just a genuine reflection of what he'd done and the overtime he'd done. And he said to me, "Steve, I want you just to do one thing." When I explained it to him, I thought he'd just be pleased and we'd move on. And he said, "I want you to hold the money for me, and I want you to arrange a way to go and give the money directly to a tattoo artist for me." And I thought, okay, this is definitely a weird conversation that I don't expect to have while we're doing ministry. Regardless of what you think about tattoos or we believe about tattoos, there's kind of this line of, I'm a missionary in a new context and a new country, and I definitely don't want to get us in trouble with anybody, so we'll err on the side of caution with everything, right? And I said, okay, explain to me, Neville, why do you want me to hold your bonus and arrange to give it to a tattoo artist? What's going on? And he showed me the tattoos that he already had on his arm. He said, "Steve, these were my gang tattoos. These are the tattoos I had in prison. And I have seen that as I've volunteered with the project and as I've worked with the young people, that when you get visitors and when certain young people come, they recognize the gang that's tattooed on my arm. They recognize what this means and what it represents. And it's now time for me to start a new chapter, and I'd love to have it covered over, and I'd love to have a decent tattoo instead of the one I had in prison." Regardless of what you think about tattoos, when someone says that to you, I defy you to say no. And my heart was, you know, absolutely, and of course we're going to try and get this arranged for you. And the next day, Neville came in with a new tattoo covering up his old ones. And I said to him, and I looked at him, and I said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "I feel like a new man, actually. I feel like I've been given a new life, and I feel as I've started again." And it was, for me, such a picture of the hope of the gospel for the individual, that he'd gone on such a journey, and he'd gone on such a kind of up and down and around sort of journey, and here he arrives. And now, you know, his dream is to be a leader in the community. That he was once a gangster in, he now dreams of being a leader and a transformer in that community. So he's working with me on an employment project that we're about to start for unemployed young people, ironically, because that's what he was. And we're working towards him being a leader and engaging in his community. The reason we've labored to talk to you about the one and to talk to you about the individual and to talk to you about people being impacted by the gospel is that we'd love to inspire you with hope that the gospel works. That what's written here, that the living hope that's here, that's good for the individual, that's good for the person that's before you, is as good in South Africa as it is in Tunbridge Wells. I honestly believe that. I don't believe there's anything special about our approach. I don't believe we know any special formula. We don't have any magic questions, any special way of operating. Just literally faith that this gospel, that this living hope, when we bring it into situations, when we come into situations with that kind of hope, and my goodness, you work in really hard ground in the UK, I get it. When we come, we see it, we feel it. Evangelistically, this is hard ground, but the gospel is good for the transformation of lives. And the hope of the gospel is that because Jesus lives, the church and the people who follow Jesus bring life into every community that they live in. We believe the gospel is good for the individual, and we also believe that the gospel and this living hope transforms communities. I alluded to the fact that we had a riot in the community, and one day we woke up to smoke at the bottom of our road, to burning tires, to men holding guns while they were all campaigning, and they were what's called a toy toy. They were toy toying. Now, a toy toy is actually a protest dance, and a protest dance, a toy toy, was very, very common during the apartheid years. That on the township, people would toy-toy, and they would campaign, and they would protest that the government would hear them. What had happened is that there had been a big dispute about public transport on the township. The public transport was one of the only really viable options for people who have got jobs to get out of the township and go to their jobs. The police had locked down the amount of licenses that were allowed, and they were stopping taxis from leaving in the mornings. So people had had a week where children weren't able to get to schools, where people weren't allowed to go to work, and eventually the situation erupted into a riot. People went out to Toi Toi and campaign, and then the riot was overtaken by young men in gangs predominantly, and they took the opportunity to ransack places, to rob, to steal, to burn buildings, and to cause chaos and havoc. There were four lines of police on every single entry point to the township where we work. People were locked in and locked down, and the attitude that was taken was anything that happens on the township during this period, we may come in and scatter it, but by and large we as the police are going to leave this to just burn itself out and lock itself out. When you're in and you're locked into a township, we live just on the outside, so we weren't locked in, but our friends and people that we work with were. It's absolutely terrifying, because effectively you're being told that you're on your own and you're being locked off. And then people started to burn down significant buildings in and around the township. The logic being that if I burn a building down, the police, the government will listen to the cry that we're giving. The government will listen to us. And that's a big problem when you've just built a building like we have, slap bang in the middle of the township. And I'll be honest with you, my first thought was, how on earth am I going to explain to everybody that supported us and helped us to build this building that within a few months we've had it burnt down? How are we going to explain that to people? I mean, there's a line that says, you know, what we do is more than the building. And that's definitely true, but not when you've only just built one, okay? And I was thinking, how on earth are we going to explain this to people? What are we going to say? And then the reports were coming in that there's people outside the building. They're still burning tires. They're still campaigning. And it's looking likely. And the word on the street is one of our buildings is also one of the targets. And they're going to burn it down. And what are we going to do? And the only thing we could do is pray. Literally, the only thing we could do is pray. We have a naff fence, right? We've got a really naff fence outside our building. We've got really good security on the building. Although we've realized if someone wants to burn down a building, there's not really much you can do about that, security-wise. We've got really good security on the building, but that doesn't include a really good perimeter fence. The reason being, if you build a really good brick-built fence, then people will jump over it, assuming that you're hiding something good on the other side, okay? So you want people to see what's on the other side so they don't try and jump over, okay? But if you build a really good metal fence that you can see through, your fence will be stolen because it will be worth something for scrap. And it will be stolen overnight, probably the first night you put it there, and it will be sold off for scrap. So you need to walk this tightrope of a naff fence that is a pain to pull down because it's got barbed wire on it, but could be cut down and could be pulled down because it's not really worth anything for scrap. Okay, so bear with us. We've got that kind of fence. And there was a group of men and a group of gangs standing outside it, and they were hammering on our lock, which is probably about a $5.99 padlock from Tesco. Okay, they were hammering on our lock with bricks, and Neville and our security guard were standing, two of them watching. And they said it was just this weird scenario that they had broken into better fences, they had pulled down more secure, stable structures, and here these men were struggling to break this small padlock with a brick. And it was almost an annoyance to them. And they said, we can't explain what happened to you. This is literally what they were saying to them. We said, we literally can't explain what happened to you. We don't know why they weren't able to get in. And then we had three prophetic words that are given to us by three different people, and they said this, that while we were praying, we saw angels bigger than the building on all of the four corners standing over it, and they had decided to protect the building. That was an interesting prophetic word for us, because in each of the four corners of the building, when we laid the foundations, we'd put Bibles and we'd put the prophetic words that were given over the building. And that was exactly the places where they told us the angels were standing. That's not linked necessarily, it's faith building, but it's not linked necessarily to why the building wasn't burnt down. The building wasn't burnt down because of God's protection through the builders who built it, because they live over the road. And they came out of their houses and they moved the burning tires that were set up outside the gate with their own hands. And they explained to the people, not this building, because this building is for the kids in the community. This building is for the young people in the community, not this building. Go and burn down other things by all means, but don't burn down here. And it showed us that the building and the work we were doing had been accepted by the community. It showed us that we had a chance in transforming the community. But more than that, A day later, I mean, these riots were hitting the press. They were the place was on lockdown. They called for all the community leaders to come and gather at the heart of the issue, right in the taxi rank in the middle of the township. Our leader, the founder of the foundation, Anton, was called to go to this meeting. And he was asked to speak. And he said one simple thing. He explained who we were, explained why we were there. And he said, if as leaders you want to gather together and you want to talk about peace and reconciliation, then our building is open to you. 2 days later, Anton and I went to the building rather sheepishly on a Saturday morning, really nervous of what was going to happen. And 127 leaders turned up and filled the top room, that double room up the top in our building. And they sung the national anthem that day as a prayer. And they opened in prayer. And they spoke about how, as leaders, they must reconcile their differences and bring peace to the community. In a building that we thought we were building for youth education, suddenly was at the heart of reconciliation for what was going on. On that day, we saw people that had instituted the riots, people that had called for the riots to happen, apologizing and hugging people who had had their buildings burnt down. In the room where we'd prayed, where we'd worshipped, where we'd asked God, would this place be a blessing of transformation for this community? They went on to elect a set of community leaders. It's a far bigger deal than your local councillor in the UK. It's far more, there's a lot riding on this if you get voted a community leader. And they held the elections for community leadership of a new structure that is going to be the Fragrant Community Development Forum. They chose sector leaders from every sector of the community, arts and culture, education, NGOs, religion, all of the different things. And they elected 70 community leaders to represent all of those sectors, of which 10 of those are to form an executive committee for the community to be able to communicate with government. On that day, the government heard of what was going on in Fragrant, in the building at Sozo, and said, we are putting on hold any decisions we're going to make about public transport because we have heard that locally democratically elected leaders are now in place and we're going to communicate with them. In a sense, it isn't about the building. It's about the transformation of a community, because I believe when we step out in faith into our communities, we see living hope. I believe that day we saw something of the gospel with legs on, in terms of the reconciliation that is possible through the gospel, in terms of this sense of serving and being relevant and being accessible to the community. But more than that, everybody knows who was there that day that it was an absolute miracle that the day after there was peace on the streets in Fragrant. Since and subsequently there has been peace on the streets in Fragrant. And that's not because we've cracked everything and it's going to be an easy ride from now on in. Absolutely not. But it's because we're prepared to sit in and dig in and fight for peace in Fragrant. But the only peace we know is that of living hope and reconciliation through the gospel and the forgiveness of those who have made mistakes and done things wrong. And everything that we know to be true of the gospel that we worship and we follow. I said in part how it impacted government. I believe that faith and hope, the hope of the gospel, is good for the government. I think we overestimate the answers that government have and we underestimate the answers that we have in the gospel. I think by and large, we assume that government has a bunch of good ideas and will eventually find a way of dealing with most of the issues. My experience has been that generally where local governments meet and where government get together, they start with the premise of, I haven't really got a clue how to deal with these issues, but let's kind of crack on and let's try. And let's see what we can do. And they had a scheme in the Western Cape. Where we are, there's probably 60% would be a kind of conservative estimate of young people are unemployed. South Africa has a third highest rate of youth unemployment in the world. There's somewhere between 50 and 60% nationally of young people between 15 and 24 are unemployed in South Africa. It's a huge issue for the country. It's a huge issue for the economy. And the Western Cape government had come up with the idea of running this youth cafes, which are cafes for young people to meet and engage and to re-engage in the workplace or to go on to further education. Now, we wanted to run a youth cafe from the Sozo building. However, here's the problem. The government didn't have any political reason to come and work in Fragrant, so didn't want to work in Fragrant. So we thought it was a really good idea, and we started to remodel the building based on a project that we didn't necessarily have access to run or do. So we were in a bit of a quandary as to whether to carry on or whether not to. And a seven-year-old boy came to visit us with his mum, and they came to look round, and he went into the part of the building that's going to be the youth cafe. And he said, Mummy, I think God wants to say something to them. I think Jesus wants to speak to them. Now, I defy you ever to close down a seven-year-old who says, I think Jesus wants to say something. You're all going to want to know what he's got to say, right? So the seven-year-old gets opportunity to speak, and he just looks up, and he says, Jesus says, finish it quick. Okay. Do you want to elaborate on that at all? Do you want to give us any more? Do you want to help us out a little bit more? No, Jesus says, finish it quick. So we've got a problem because we're standing in a building that we're desperately trying to finish. We're trying to fund every little bit to get over the line. And here's a part of the building that we could easily not finish because we've had no grounding to start this project other than we believe it's a God idea and not just a good idea. And now this seven-year-old boy has told us that Jesus says, finish it quick. So finish it quick, we do, because we kind of go with it, right? We believe God speaks, and so we say, okay, we're going to finish this. We're going to go for it. Now, here's the problem. We had some government officials coming to launch the building on the day that you saw and to come and do the kind of cut the ribbon and all of that sort of jazz. Now, they then go into the part of the building that's a youth cafe, which, bear in mind, is their idea, okay? But they haven't commissioned us to do it. So it's effectively like us telling them we're going to run one of their projects without any permission from them to run one of their projects, okay? So that's a kind of awkward conversation we're having. It looks great. It looks really good. And they go back and email other people in the Western Cape government and say, this was so good, the launch was great, and the youth cafe is really, really interesting. The person above them in the office says, youth cafe in Vreeland? I've never heard of that. And then emails their boss and says, have you heard of that? They then email their boss, and we are getting nervous because we're like, had no contact with the government. They're not funding what we're doing. And now very high up the pecking order in the Western Cape government, which is a big deal, we're suddenly causing grief about the fact that we've said we're running a project that they've not asked us to run, that we're doing because a seven-year-old has told us that Jesus told us to finish it quickly. We can't reply to the Minister of Social Development and say, well, I don't know why we did it. A seven-year-old came and asked us to do it. So they come and visit us, and they listen to what we're going to do. They listen to the plans of what we're going to do in the centre, and they're all kind of writing in their notebooks and scratching their heads and wondering what they should do about us. And as we leave, they say, we're going to contact you. I get a phone call, and it goes like this. He says, is that Steve? I said, yes, it's Steve. Hi, and he doesn't say his name. He says, Steve is not what we're going to call you anymore. Man of faith is what we're going to call you. And I said, okay, I'm definitely speaking to someone from church, right? Because that's a killer opening line from someone from church. And they said, and your faith has been rewarded as it's been heard of. And I thought, okay. And I said, who am I speaking to? And he said his name. And he said, I'm the youth development officer for the whole of the Western Cape. And we've heard about what you're doing, and your faith has been rewarded because we're going to partner with you and we're going to fund you for what you're doing with the youth cafes. We're coming out to visit you tomorrow. This is the way they work. We're coming out to visit you tomorrow to discuss the details. So I said, okay, you can come, no problem. Come and sit down. And they, a long short of the conversation is that they've come and sat with us. And there was a prophetic word over what we were doing, which came about 2 years ago. The prophetic word said this, that the government is going to come to you and it is going to copy what you're doing because you're going to set a model for them to learn from. Here's the conversation that they said. They said, we'd love you to train 500 unemployed young people. We laughed and said, there's absolutely no way we can train 500. But we could do 50. What do you think? So we negotiated and we got down to 50, but we're going to try and do more in the future. And they gave us a significant amount of money to do it. And as they were leaving, they looked around and they said, well, it'd been a really long conversation about what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. As they were leaving, they said this. They said, we're really interested to watch what happens here. For a number of reasons, this is very different to the other youth cafes we've got. And this will be a model that we are watching closely so we can learn from it to implement in other areas. Now, I can only tell you that it's an idea we have, that when I go back, I'm going to be project managing 50 young people. We're going to have them for 6 months. We're going to try and train them in four different streams. We're going to train them as baristas and in hospitality. We're going to train others in digital graphic design, basics in computers and coding. We're going to train others as handymen and women and give them the basics of the building industry. And we're going to run others through an entrepreneur and a business scheme. And we're hoping that all 50 of them are going to get jobs at the end. And we start with a ridiculous hope that no one's going to drop out, that everyone's going to go to them to work, and that everything's going to work well. We're going to learn the hard way that maybe that won't happen, but we're sure it's a God idea. We're sure he's in it. We're sure he's asked us to do it. And we believe that living hope is so good, and the resurrection of Jesus is so good, that even governments may come and say, do you know what, we could learn off of you guys because we think you're onto something here and we think you're going to do it well. And I believe the same for you. I come with absolute sure and conviction of faith that on the week like this week, more than any other, we should have an amazing hope in the gospel. That if this crazy story that we celebrate is true, that Jesus is God, that God came to earth, that God died on a cross and rose from the dead, that we may be saved and enjoy forever in communion with him and then in heaven where the Trinity reside. I mean, what a crazy story of hope and of redemption. Grace is the most outrageous, scandalous truth that we know. And if that doesn't inspire us to believe that we're holders of living hope in a week like this, then we need our pulses checked. Because if I've learned one thing from these young people is that they are full of passion for both themselves and their future and for their gospel. They are full of passion, excitement and vigor. People would say that Diana and I are passionate. I had to close Diana down when she's talking about sanitary towels. I mean, that is how passionate she is about young women. You would have to close me down tonight. I am checking my phone because I know I will run over time unless I'm really, really disciplined. Because we love this. We love it, but how much more are we challenged by the passion of the people that we work with on the ground in South Africa? My goodness me, these young people are full of faith for the gospel. Full of faith for the gospel. And it's such a challenge to me, and I want to be a provocative challenge to you that asks you whether you're full of faith and hope and love for Tunbridge Wells. Whether if I cut you open, at your core, you are screaming, yes, there is more than this. And it's found in the truth of the gospel. And it's found in the resurrection of Jesus. And it's as good for him in South Africa and for her in South Africa as it is for me here in Tunbridge Wells. Because what we celebrate this week doesn't just reside on paper. It resides in hearts. And it resides in lives. And it resides in transformation of individuals all over the earth, of communities all over the earth. And we hope that it will be an example to governments who really don't know what to do about the hopelessness that they face sometimes in everyday human situations. So our kind of prophetic encouragement, if you like, to you would be, what is the more for you? What is the hope for you? What is the living hope you have that as the gospel is lived and breathed and comes to life in Tunbridge Wells, what could that look like? What would it mean for us as a community of believers in this place to bring life to Tunbridge Wells? What does that look like? What does bringing life in these streets and in these homes and for the people that you reside with look like? For us, this is bringing us life. More than we've had in years, this brings us to life. For Fragrant, we pray that the project, alongside all the other good work that's going on in the community and all the other churches, we hope that this is bringing life and bringing gospel hope and transformation in the community. And here we would long to hear, and we do hear stories, and we would long to hear more stories coming from the UK, coming from the streets of England, that cry out that Jesus is living. And you know what? Everybody thinks it's been tried, tested, and failed. So what have you got to lose? They think we're going to fail anyway. The glorious truth of the gospel is that we don't, and Jesus redeemed it, and the church will never be overcome. And in the meantime, right now, we're batting off a wicket where everybody expects you to fail. So the living hope, when it springs up, will be as much as a surprise to them as it probably will be to you. And it will be a glorious surprise that will come out of somewhere that they never expect it, from a group of people that they never thought would do anything as outrageous as that which we will do. And the gospel's never done anything different since the times when Jesus was walking and preaching and teaching, and nobody expected it to come from there, from him, from that place. Salvation sprang. Why not from here? Why not from us? Why not from the churches and the streets that we inhabit? We pray next year as we put our head down and we work hard that we see unemployed young people find work, that we see girls restored to dignity, that our social workers stop people being abused and being in horrible situations. that nobody drops out of school, that we play our part in transforming the educational framework in the situation where we're based, that we go on to see many employed and many saved, that we go on more and primarily above anything else to see young people filled with the hope of the gospel, because it's all we know. We've gone halfway around the world to realize that all we really know is what's written here, that those who are filled with salvation, those who are filled with the gospel, are those who are birthed into living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We're open to taking questions. We're open. We've got about 10 minutes, probably a little bit less. We'd love you to ask us anything. We'd love to kind of share with you. Napoleon says a leader is a dealer in hope. So I hope we've led well tonight, and we've inspired you to hope, and we've inspired you for the more. And I finish where I started, which is genuinely thank you. Thank you to the leaders. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Carol. Thank you to the leaders of the church. Thank you to you. These stories are your stories. They're not just ours. We'd love you to take some ownership over them and feel proud of what's going on there. And we genuinely want to say thank you for partnering with us and enabling this to happen. So thank you.
Steve, thank you so much. Diana, thank you as well. It would be great if people would like to ask questions, if there's more or that you'd like to know or particular things about what's going on in South Africa or whatever. So just put a hand up and I'll run around with the microphone. No silence.
Stunned silence now, yeah.
Mary.
Steve, you mentioned prayer a lot, not surprisingly. And one thing we wondered, in one of your, I can't remember where it was, your blog or something, was it mentioned a 24/7 prayer room? And can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I can. Do you want to, or do you want me to? I'll do it. Okay. So what had happened is, before we left, a 14-year-old girl gave us a prophecy. It sounds like we always act off these stuff. I don't know why. There's a 14-year-old girl gave us a prophecy, and it said, build a prayer room or a chapel on a site. Build it big and you'll fill it. Build it small and you'll fill it, but make sure you build it. So we've been attempting to build it for like a year. It's actually completed now, and it's a space outside. We've never stopped building. We ran out of space for offices and for other things, so it kind of morphed into other things over the time. We feel challenged as a team. We were 20 at that stage. We're 33 now. We feel challenged as a team that for every hour we serve in the community, which is roughly 40 hours a week, we want to see people in the prayer room holding a rope for us at all times. So at that stage, that would have meant everyone on staff would have to pray for 2 hours a week, and we would always have somebody praying for the hours that we were working. So there's always been something special for us about believing that where we put our feet down somewhere, we can claim the land, and we can. There's something special about praying on a plot of land or on a space. So we wanted to be right in the heart where we were. We built an interactive prayer room. So you'll go in there and you'll be able to write on the walls. There'll be different displays that are up that were very much like 24/7 Prayer UK. That's been our kind of inspiration and our heart, as they've helped us a lot. And we hope, I don't think we'll be doing any overnight stuff yet. We'd kind of had to hide out, and, you know, night times are scary times, eh? Like, it's when a lot of stuff goes on, yeah. So for us now, I think we've got faith to cover the whole daytime shift in prayer. And our heart is just that we would really meet and encounter God in that place. And, you know, the reality is that the spiritual atmosphere over that area isn't going to change without people really dedicating and crying out to God. I don't really know what that always looks like. I don't often know what that means. I just know that the more we've gone on this ride, the more I've often felt like I need to pray and meet with God. I don't really have any smart answers anymore. I think as a young man, I'm still quite young, but as a younger man, I had quite a lot of smart answers. I thought were smart. And I've just learned that actually I've got less answers now. And I need to wrestle with God for longer in prayer. I need to listen to God a lot more than talk. I think he's got more to say to me than I've got to say to him. And I've learned just to sit still and be still for longer and hear God's voice on what we're doing rather than run ahead and try and constantly do it. So that place is unashamedly for us as staff. It's to give us breath. It's to give us life. It's so that we meet with God. It's so that we encounter God.
But also in remembering the authority we have in Christ, I think it's very like easy to get bogged down by all the things we have to do, or if we're like all the practical things and the things we want to do. And yeah, like I journal like mad and I write a million things that I want to do. But if it's not like rooted in knowing that we are at war, it's not against flesh and blood. And that a lot of these issues are from, you know, so like generational, and that the enemy does when he gets hold of something, he will just like latch on like a leech on the lives of these young people, anywhere we're trying to impact. So that's where the battle comes, like just in prayer and intercession. And because with some of the girls that I was working with, I was like, okay, so, you know, how are we going to structure this, and how are we going to talk to them about, you know, like freedom and Christ in certain areas, and the abusive relationships and all of this. And all we tried to model was something really positive and a really good structure, but behind, you know, the scene, like we were really interceding for them. And one of them, just actually a couple of them, have kind of not even to me, but to different like tutors in the center, said, I now decided, you know, I really feel like God has a purpose for me, that I need to take pride in being a woman, that you know, there's nothing wrong with being a woman, that God has that purpose for me, and I'm just going to leave this abusive relationship, and I'm really going to try, or I'm going to focus on my education. And so they come to those conclusions, and you think, well, I never specifically told that young lady to make that decision, but it's because when you speak to young people, you're talking not to them, but I think like just directly to their spirit and to the soul that's like right there, and that is battling whether they realize it or not in the spiritual realm. So that's where a lot of the like almost karate chopping happens.
Question, but you can see why we need it. Yeah, that's our war room. So yeah.
Anyone else? How can people keep up with what you're doing? I get your blog. I can't remember the address off the top of my head. Is it simple to remember? Should I all be able to remember it? It just appears in my email. It's that easy for me. Yeah. But once I've done it, I kind of, you know, can't remember how it just appears.
So there's a monthly email newsletter that you can sign up to. So if you want to do that, you can give us your email address, and we'll update you monthly with our prayer letter, which is what was alluded to there. That's what you're receiving. I keep a blog. I probably don't blog as much as I should. I keep getting told off for that. That's mrstevemorris.wordpress.com, I think. But it's linked off the prayer letter. So really, to be honest, if you're on Twitter, you can follow me on Twitter, and there's links to stuff from there. If you're on Facebook, the Sozo Foundation is on Facebook, so you could like the page there. But probably the most simplest way to kind of get it all would be to give your email address to us, and then we'll put you on the list, and every month you'll receive an email update in your inbox, and we love you to pray for us and kind of keep us in, holding us up in prayer that way. So yeah, so
brilliant. What can we specifically pray for you guys?
So we would always cover prayers for our kids. Our son Caleb is coming up to 5 now. He's just started primary school. So our daughter is just coming up to 2 years old, and she starts preschool as soon as we go back. They've settled really, really well, but we don't take that for granted. So we'd love you to pray for them. I think we would love you to pray for the youth cafe. It's no small task to have 50 unemployed young people starting a training program in June. Mm. And humanly speaking, the buck for the program stops with me. So I'd love you to pray that we can pull this off. It feels a bit like we're kind of going back into a whirlwind that we're hoping to pull off. I have so many emails I haven't answered yet. So I'm keen that we'd love you to pray for that. And probably the final thing would be that you would pray for the community leadership structures that are very new, that have been established, people are genuinely speaking about this potentially being a model for reconciliation and democratic election of local leaders that could be replicated in other townships. I think it's too early for that to be said. That's said by other people that are coming in, but it gives you an idea of the kind of scale of what people are seeing has happened. So I would love you to pray for those leaders. I think they're at a really tender stage of trying to do something locally that could be effective. And Anton, our friend and the guy who set this up with his wife Alana, is actually the deputy chairman for the committee. It's quite a big deal because he's a white South African Afrikaans man. And the chairman of the committee is a Khoza black South African man. And the committee is made up of cross-cultural languages and dynamics, and it's beautiful if it works. It will be broken if it doesn't. It will reinforce a load of negative stereotypes that already exist if it doesn't. But they are faith-filled for it. So, yeah, I could go on, but actually we could just, yeah, it'd be great for people to pray for that, yeah.